So we have Dennis from Alaska Children and Child and Family in Anchorage, and he is going to tell us about his presentation at the Joint Commission Surveyor Training Conference, which was just a few weeks ago. This is the first time that NACBH has been invited to participate, and we were glad that Dennis was able to. He did a presentation on outcomes and how they're used. And Dennis, we will turn it over to I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. All right. Good. And, you know, we have on the line Jeannie, who didn't participate in the presentation. But most of the thing that I'm going to be talking about really is the result of Jeannie and her department's hard work. So when we get into some details, if you'd like to really get dig deeper, I would appreciate, Jeannie, if you'd step up. But anyway, as you said, we were invited to present to the conference. I will tell you some just general observations that, you know, always surprises me. For example, I think children's behavioral health services, you know, is like front and center everywhere. Except, of course, when you're at Joint Commission, when you have a subset of surveyors that are in behavioral health, and even fewer that have not working knowledge of the children's behavioral health side of things. So it's a fairly large conference with a lot of surveyors. And then when you whittle down the behavioral health surveyors, we ended up in a room where I would imagine there were about 50 surveyors in that room. So compared to what I would imagine would be almost over 1,000 people at the conference, so or maybe I'm exaggerating, but it certainly looked that way. I found it interesting that the this year's conference has an acronym, MOSAIC, and you know, just to explain what MOSAIC means, meaningful assessment is the M, ongoing improvement is the O, success in simplification is the S, advancing our commitment to excellence. I is inspiring through innovation, and the C is collaborating and celebrating. So that was the context of the conference, the training, and as you said, we were invited, and actually I think most purposefully we were invited because we do represent the children's behavioral health side of things. And I do believe, Pat, that we will be invited again. Hopefully I did a good enough job to be re-invited. But Victor Spence, who you know really coordinated the behavioral health side, made a point to say that they really need to continue to get the children's behavioral health side of things, and they were very thankful that NECBH stepped up to the plate. So my presentation was on data and outcomes and how they are used. But when and if do people have the slides that
yes.
Pat sent out?
Yes.
So I'm gonna skip around a little bit, and I'm just gonna move to slide number 3, and this just helped give some perspective to where at least I started to really begin to look at outcomes and data, and it really started for me. Well, a little bit before this, but certainly pushed us in this direction when the Joint Commission started with their Oryx initiative. And interestingly enough, I could not find anybody in Chicago that remembered exactly when Oryx initiative started for the behavioral health side of things. All the surveyors and all the staff couldn't quite remember when that was. Pat, do you have a recollection of when that was?
Oh, golly. I want to say maybe 1998.
That's kind of what I was thinking, too. I thought it was right at the end of the century. But and that actually moved us into, as an organization, as NACBH, I think it was probably called NAPSE at the time, to the instrument that we were trying to develop called the Results-Based Treatment Initiative. And that's on a journey. Uh-oh, I'm getting some feedback here. That sent us on a journey for at least a subcommittee of the organization to begin to take a look at what outcomes might look like and how we might develop outcomes, and specifically, which didn't happen, how we would develop benchmarks so that we could do some comparison in our field. So I think we were successful in some areas and not so successful in others. And that probably had to do with the fact that there was an initial push to move in this direction driven by the Joint Commission, and then that kind of faded away, and therefore the organization some of the members of the organization didn't support taking RBTI, or Results-Based Initiative, to its full fruition. But we were successful at developing a uniform definition of treatment settings. As we all know, what an RPTC is in one state is a group home in another, and on throughout the full continuum. We did try to develop what we called severity ratings, which were just tools like the CAFIS or the Devereaux and some of the others. We were all using different CANs. We were all using different tools, screening scales, and some of us were actually mandated to use those tools by the state, and so we didn't want to have programs developing, having to do more than one screening tool, and so what we had hoped to be able to do is somehow crosswalk the different screening scales that we were using. That never happened because that would have really cost us quite a bit to make it happen, I believe. We did, I think, move quite a ways in determining what outcomes to measure, and certainly AK Child and Family has profited from that, because that's really the direction that we took when we developed our outcome scale, our outcome measures some years ago. And then, of course, we had discussions on who owned the outcomes, which I think pretty clearly we felt like each organization that were involved owned the outcomes. But then how to disseminate, we didn't get quite that far. But I just wanted to start there because that actually gave a number of us in the field. At the time, I was at Utihale in Omaha, and certainly AK Child and Family and other organizations. I think there were a number of initiatives that Devereaux was very, out in front on at times. So there were a number of us, I think, that really began back in those days to take a look at what outcomes were and really. And really start using that data to improve our program, and certainly that legacy has continued here at AK Child and Family, and I believe in other organizations across NECBH and probably across the country. Stop me if you have questions, but I moved quickly, by the way, on page four, on slide four, to explaining at least my perspective on how data and information and what I call really feedback should be used. And it moves us from this Newtonian thinking where it's kind of top-down. Newtonian thinking really is that, that organizations are more like machines and, departments and individuals work as cogs in those machines. And if people would just do what their bosses say, everything would be great. And certainly if they did what the CEO says, it would be wonderful. That's supposed to be a joke. Anyway, I certainly, probably back about the time that Oryx was around, in the late 90s, began to see the organization that that I was involved in as a living system. And in living systems, I believe, and by the way, this comes from the first person that really influenced me a lot on my thinking this way was a woman named Margaret Wheatley. In fact, a book that she put out probably in the early 90s, I probably picked it up in about 95, 96, was Leadership and the New Science. And, you know, that certainly influenced the way I began to take a look at the organizations that I was involved in and, you know, really believing that what living systems need to evolve, and in our case, what living systems need, or organizations like AKA Child and Family need, is a good feedback loop so that they can evolve. And so while certainly the outcomes and data and information is all valuable to leadership, and certainly we use it, I think it is even more valuable to the individuals within the organization. So that was really kind of the backdrop of the way I present the information I gave to the Joint Commission. So on slide number five, you know, the first thing you have to point out is certainly there continues to be, and even since the early 90s, you know, continues to be an increase accountability by outside, you know, outsiders. So, you know, the Joint Commission, for example, or the federal government, if you have some of the federal grants, or Medicaid, or the state. Certainly, we have been more and more accountable for the outcomes that we provide, and you know, if you go down to the legislature, which I do too often, you know, certainly that's the first thing when you get into a meaningful conversation that you run into is, well, behavioral health, we really don't know what we're paying for. So to be able to have, and I do, by the way, thanks to Jeannie and her department, to be able to have at my ready outcomes data in a way that they can understand it is very helpful. So, but that said, I don't really see that as the main reason that we really collect data and that we look at outcomes. I think the main reason is that, you know, to get that feedback to our employees, to get that feedback to our volunteers and our board members, to help them make daily decisions as well as strategic decisions. And as important, I believe, is we have to get the input, we have to get the data, the feedback, the outcomes to our consumers. That is why we have, I think for the last 5 years, maybe four, we have put all of our outcomes or our outcome data out on our website so that the parents who are placing their children and the referral agencies that are placing the children in our services can see our outcomes and make informed decisions. I think it's very important that we be that transparent because they are the ones that are trying to decide how to best help their children, and what better way to do that but to put those outcomes out into a place where they can that help them make a decision. So on slide number seven, you know, I just really went into how, first of all, we are really trying to kind of formalize the informal communication, the water cooler conversation within our organization. So it's so easy, for example, in a residential program for our, you know, in our case, our boys' cottages, thinking that perhaps, well, in fact, this has been a statement that has been debunked, is that we are accepting much more aggressive youth these days. And therefore, you know, in an organization that has sworn off restraint and seclusion, we're tying their hands. And we were able to kind of show through some of our outcome data that that just wasn't the case. And so being able to take that and then begin to take a look at the real data around it can help us actually make an informed decision on what we are experiencing. So if they're not more aggressive, then what is it that we're experiencing, and what should we be doing within our cottages in order to move, to evolve to a place where we're improving the treatment? So what we try to do, and again, Jeannie's department is really good at this, is we make, you know, we have these discussions, we make decisions about directions that we're going, and we then develop matrix or dashboards in order for us to not only make the decision, but also then follow whether or not the decisions we made, the process that we've developed, actually are making a difference in the direction that we like. So getting back to a little bit of our outcome, some of the data that we collect, one of the areas is really kind of our outcome study, which we've been doing for, what, Jeannie, about 10 years now, a little bit over?
Oops, sorry, I was on mute. A little bit over that.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So we use the CAFAS, we use the Child and Adolescent Functional Assessment Scale, and we use it in a way that we, at admission, 90 days, every 90 days after admission, at discharge, and then we do a survey using points of the CAPAS, 6, 12, and 18 months. So we really get an idea of whether or not the treatment that we provided sticks over a long period of time. So that's kind of the... That's certainly one of the areas, and that's the information we put out on our website, we put in our brochures, we talk about, actually, when I talk to donors, that's what we use. But there's also certainly other data that we use, other feedback that we use that really helps inform the daily decision-making that we go through. The outcome study is one. I've moved from 8 to 9 now. Our annual consumer satisfaction survey is also very front and center. We also publish information about that. Various data points in our electronic medical records, and I think, you know, it's kind of needless to say, but mining our electronic medical records has really become a big piece of how we inform decisions within those subcommittees and those groups that really are set to take a look at the different issues that we have. But we go beyond that. In slide 10, we also do an annual employee survey, and of course we look at risk events and certainly that's valuable information for us, and drug incident reports and those type of things. On slide 11, I talk about, this kind of information is used in treatment planning and ongoing treatment assessments, but it's also used in subcommittees. We use it in departmental work groups. It's used in team meetings and certainly leadership, as well as our board of directors. All use this data to, once again, take this living system and help it evolve into a better place. Help it evolve to a place where we're meeting the needs of the kids and the families that we work with at a higher percentage. I went into, of course, with my hour and a half presentation, how to develop healthy teams. So using Patrick Lencioni's work, I'm not going to get into that today. Anybody that went to the annual conference certainly heard a lot about that. But you have to be able to have teams that trust each other, that can deal with conflict, that can make commitments, that can hold each other accountable, and that can really focus on the results that we all agree upon. So one of the things I went into, and again, critical to having teams that really can work together, that can trust each other, is the fact that we do value successes. This is on slide 13. We do value our successes, but most importantly, actually, we really celebrate uncovering of the mistakes, because that's where the feedback and that's where the decisions can really, you know, help us evolve in the direction that we want. So recognize our mistakes. Recognize that what the team's part in those mistakes are. So often, people know that mistakes are happening, but they're shy to hold each other accountable. So to develop teams where we can actually recognize those mistakes and then move us to a place where we can learn and we can make changes, and then we can follow up on those changes to make sure that we get the desired results. Now, I went through probably at this point in my presentation, I went through five or six, and you can see those in the slides, five or six different ways that we used data outcomes to develop changes within the organization. I'm getting close to the time that I should be stopping, so I'm wondering if you want me to at least do one of those examples. Or do we want to stop and just for questions?
Do people have questions?
This is Pat. I would like to go through one of the examples. I'm flipping through the slides to see what grabs me.
Let me just use one of the examples that I find pretty intriguing, because I think it points out some of the dilemmas that we have. It's on slide 25, and it's one of our more recent quandaries, I'll put it, and that is we have a fairly significant number of treatment foster homes, and we have a team of people that are very, very dedicated to making sure that the kids that are placed in the foster homes don't have placement disruption, or maybe put it a different way. So many of the kids that we've worked with have gone through so many different foster homes and placements that it's really valuable to us to make sure that we have a good match, so that when we place a child in a foster home, we have a really good chance that we're not going to, you know, that's not going to disrupt. And so that's caused us to really take a laborious approach to making sure that that happens. And in some case, that meant, and on slide 25 you can see it, it was taking quite a long time for us to place children from referral to placement. And so it's such a long time that we probably saw more kids go to other services than come to ours, because we were trying to make sure that those kids didn't come to us for a short period of time and then move on. That's a valuable approach to things. But the problem was that is that by taking that long, more kids than not perhaps got placed, we don't know this for sure, but perhaps got placed in placements that weren't as good. And in fact, some of the kids may have, because they had to wait so long, ended up back in residential treatment or in a group home or maybe lost hope altogether. So we spent time looking at how we could reduce that time but stay committed to placing kids, to making sure that we were placing kids in foster homes that really do match. And that continues to be a struggle for us, but we are starting to see some success by, one, taking a look at it, and, two, bringing a subcommittee of people together to determine what are the things that we necessarily have to have. And this includes bringing foster parents in to talk about what are they looking for and see if we could make it more uniform so that we, one, we can make sure that we're placing kids in the right foster homes, but at the same time cut down the time so that we can certainly be more successful. Is still a work in progress, but is one of the things that I want to point out. You know, it's not that when we look at things that we're not looking at the right result. In this case, trying to make sure, that we place kids in a good matched foster home. But what more do we need so that we can have actually the results that we're looking for? And in this case, being more successful in a shorter period of time. And I think we're beginning to see some of the success. If you take a look at slide number 26, you can see that the number of youth on our waiting list, our goal is certainly to get that number down, and we started in September to start seeing a reduction, and I think it was based upon some of the work that we're doing.
Hmm.
Other questions or comments or other slides that you see that you might want a little bit more explanation?
Hi, this is Ken out in Arizona. I have a question.
Sure.
And I apologize, I did dial in a little late. You may have addressed this, but what did you do to identify and obtain the technical and staff resources to determine this process that you needed to go through, create the process, implement it, and sustain it like this?
Well, Ken, some of it's trial and error, the good news is that we've been committed to this process since, well, I wasn't here at the time, but it appears to me that this organization's been committed to it since the early 2000s, and certainly the process that we used was a process that was developed actually by the results-based treatment initiative that that NECBH started way back when. And we, for the last 10 years, have just really found value in doing it to the point where it's self-perpetuating at this point. The board of directors certainly buy into it. We get recognized throughout the state for the outcomes approach that we take by not only our peers but the legislature, our donors. We actually used outcome data on a donor letter last year, and we were very successful. So people certainly have supported us in moving in this direction. Jeannie, you might want to add a little bit more to that. I don't know if you have any more to add.
Well, I'm not sure what more to add, because I came in after the outcomes program had been pretty well established, or at least the longevity of the data collection had been established. And when I came in, it was really that commitment that the organization made to stick with it and continue to use the CAFAs, continue to collect data, continue to use their tier data in a way to inform decisions, it was really coming to a head when I came on, and it's really been great to see the outcomes of that. I think a lot of organizations don't see the value because they don't stick with it to really collect enough data to have it be meaningful in the long run. And this organization has done that. So as soon as I came on, it was great because I had all of this information. I had all of this buy-in from leadership. People were really ready to really dig into this information and use it in a meaningful way to inform decisions. So I guess the only thing I can say from my perspective, being the head of this department, is just having people kind of go through it for the long haul and holding on and really continuing to collect that information so it becomes meaningful. Because after about 5 years, all of a sudden you have all of this information that can really help answer questions that maybe people have been thinking about for years and didn't really have solid information on how to give a good direction to turn. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
That helps. Thank you.
You know, the other thing I just wanted to add, and I think that we've got, in our field, we have to make sure that we're not just collecting outcomes to prove to the federal government or the state government or Joint Commission or whatever surveyor that's coming through that we're doing an adequate job. It really has to, if we can use the data to as feedback to help inform decisions, down at the level where the kids and the families are getting the services, then it perpetuates itself because then it's not we're doing it for other people; it's really doing it for our benefits. And if we can use this data, information to help the line staff make decisions on everyday decisions, that's where I think the longevity comes in.
And I think also, not to jump in again, but also to make sure that it's kind of a fault-free reporting. The purpose, I think from our perspective as an organization, the purpose of this reporting isn't to show how great we are. It is to look at where we're going and where we're ebbing and flowing and where do we need to apply our resources and what do we need to be looking at, what do we need to be focusing on. So the purpose of reporting, I think, in some organizations can be a kind of a fault finding, particularly with risk reporting. That was a struggle with the risk. People were very fearful of reporting risks because they didn't want it to look badly on themselves or their departments. But once they started getting into the groove of understanding, like, oh, the purpose of this is so we can help you and we can all help each other become better at what we do, people's buy-in became stronger and people were using it in a more meaningful way at the supervisory manager floor staff level. So I kind of wanted to piggyback off of what Dennis was saying there. And that's a culture shift. That's shifting how people look at these numbers as opposed to using them as a tool as opposed to just a reporting tool, using it as a tool for change.
Other questions?
Yeah, this is Pat again. How do you keep it dynamic enough that you're changing the questions that you ask while maintaining some consistency of the questions you ask over time, so that you have comparable data without it just getting huge, just adding on and adding on?
Well, it is a challenge, I think. We have, of course, the main outcomes survey or outcomes program that we have, which is using the CAFAs and domains that the CAFAs present to you. So that's, I think, the consistency. But I think when it comes to looking at mistakes or looking at problems that are presented and then digging in and help inform what that problem is or how that mistake happens, and then come together and make decisions on how we're going to correct it in the future, and then finding ways to measure whether or not we are moving in the right direction. Those things happen, I want to say, organically, and quite often will be specific to a department or a cottage or a group of staff, and so they then move it along. We had a situation where we were having a more against clinical advice discharges in our girls' campus, on our girls' campus, compared to our boys' campus, and so a group of people on our girls' campus really took a look at what were the things that were happening that would cause that. And it's in some of the slides here. One of the things that we determined was these against clinical advice discharges happened after, not to be surprising, after some communication that was stressful for the youth and the family between themselves. I mean, basically it was, you know, arguments over the phone and those type of things, or, you know, not getting along during sessions or during visits or those type of things. And we saw discharges, again, parents pulling their kids out after those events. We also found that it happened around the holidays. So we put things in place, to red flag those times when those stressful conversations were happening, and instead of just marking it down in our chart, we actually talked about, you know, what can we do to help the child and their family through this hard time. And of course, the holidays, we really began to look at what are the things that we do to really include families so that they don't feel this need to pull their child out during the holiday. And that group of staff really took that on and continues. This past holiday, they were back at making sure that they were using some of the same tools that they have the last 3 or 4 years, because they've seen some real success dropping it down. I think one slide shows, you know, we went from, you know, 13 against clinical advice discharges 1 year down to 4 by the time we really implemented this plan. So they keep, they keep it fresh by finding, reasons to begin to take a look at how do we do something better. And it stays with them so that it isn't the entire agency that's working on all these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just to piggyback off of Dennis and your question, really our CAFIS outcomes, our risk management data, the bigger picture points don't really fluctuate that much. So that way we have a consistency there. However, the departments, the committees, the way that we distribute the need-to-know information for different committees and departments, like let's say my Environment of Care Committee, really focuses on the 5 or 6 big picture data points of the risk report. And when they notice a fluctuation or something that is shifting, that would prompt them to drill down. And that's really training and continuing that message of embedding the access to this data. So that way the committee knows that if I see this fluctuation, I can go back to the performance improvement department and say, you know, I need to drill down a little further. Can you give me these are the questions we have, help us answer them. Because we're trying to figure out why this fluctuation may have happened. So then the committee kind of takes that on, or the department takes that on to drill down, identify their own data points, and then track and trace that for a period of time until the bigger picture data point goes back up again. Does that answer your question? Does that make sense?
So it
keeps it dynamic and fluid, and people are more engaged because they're using it as a tool to inform their decisions. So.
I think we've probably used up our time, but, you know, I'm certainly not, I don't want to cut off questions.
Any other questions? Okay, I will take that as a no. And I guess we can move on to Ken to hear about his survey.
Let me stop the recording so that Ken may speak freely.
Oh, goodness.